Hello and welcome to the programme which looks at the Holy Land. I am Paul Calvert. Psalm 82, verse 3 and 4 from the New King James Bible says this: Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Free them from the hand of the wicked. I'm with Richard Heidemann, a lawyer in Washington, D.C., and today we're talking about holding sponsors of terror legally accountable. Now, Richard, if someone has been involved in a terror attack, can you hold sponsors of terror accountable?
Paul, yes, thank you very much for hosting me today. I'm honored and appreciative. This is an important topic. Long before October 7th, we were focusing for the last 24 years on representing American victims of terror. I'm senior counsel of Heidemann, Nudelman, and Kalik, the Washington, D.C. law firm that has been representing American victims of terror in cases against Libya, Syria, Iran, Arabbank PLC, the Palestinian Authority, and others who we have accused of providing material support for terror. As you well know, Paul, during the Second Intifada, there were cases, situations, tragic attacks all over Israel. But this was not the first wave of terror in Israel. Israel has faced terror against her citizens, visitors, business people, even diplomats from the State Department who have suffered loss of life or limb. And what we have done over these last decades is represent American victims and their families under U.S. law that allows them to bring litigation in U.S. federal court. There's essentially two prongs. First, against state sponsors of terror. By state sponsors of terror, I'm referring to the countries that are on the U.S. Department of State list of state sponsors of terror. Presently, that's the Syrian Arab Republic, which has been on since 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran, that's been on since 1985, and also both North Korea and Cuba, which came off the list but are back on the list. Those four countries can all be sued by American victims of terror. And that means claims not only for those who have been killed or injured, but also their American family members, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, spouses, and children. There were three other countries that were on the State Department list. They're off now, so they have their immunity back, if you will. Those countries include Iraq and Libya and Sudan. They were all sued, and some of them actually reached settlement agreements, such as Libya and Sudan. And our firm was involved in representing American victims of Libyan-sponsored Abu Nidal attacks from the 1980s, hijackings, and the attacks on the Rome and Vienna airports. And other law firms were involved as well in various cases. Libya actually settled and agreed to pay $1.5 billion, which was received, and then paid out essentially $10 million a family for deaths and $3 million a family approximately for injuries. So there are prongs that allow in the courts for cases to be brought. The second prong is under what's called the Anti-Terrorism Act, where non-governments, non-sovereigns can be sued. That means banks and charities and foundations and funders and others who support terror. And many lawsuits have been brought, some successfully, some not successfully. And we're working today with Congress to help improve the laws that will allow terror victims and their families to continue to use not only the courts, but the court of public opinion as a weapon against this terror war.
So can people actually sue a country, and can they actually physically get the money from that country?
Yes, as I mentioned with Libya, we sued both the Libyan government, but also Gaddafi when he was then alive. in federal court in Washington, D.C., and it led to an order that we should be allowed, Paul, to take the deposition of Gaddafi. And prior to that deposition, we met with Gaddafi's personal lawyers, and it helped lead to the eventual settlement agreement that was reached between the U.S. government and the government of Libya, pursuant to which Libya actually paid $1.5 billion. The money came to the U.S. Treasury and then was distributed out to the families and to the attorneys representing the families for their fees and expenses. And in cases under the Anti-Terrorism Act, that's the non-governmental entities, one of the lead cases is the case that was brought on behalf of Hamas victims of the Second Intifada and other victims. But the Hamas victims case was actually tried in federal court in New York. The jury found Arab Bank liable for having funded Hamas. And before the damages trial, the case was settled. It was a confidential settlement. I can't comment on it, but it was very significant. And the press has reported the number of zeros included in that settlement. So yes, victims of terror can sue in U.S. federal court, and they can recover. Once they get their judgments, they can do two things. One, they can use the judgment to attempt to attach assets, even of the countries. And the second thing is they can go into a congressionally created U.S. Victims of State-Sponsored Terror Fund by filing a claim that essentially registers their federal court judgment against a foreign state sponsor of terror. Again, the present countries listed are Syria, Iran, North Korea, and Cuba. And we have actually been engaged by a number of families as a result of the heinous Hamas barbaric massacre of October 7th. And we're preparing strategic litigation now to be filed on behalf of those families, both pursuant to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act against Iran and Syria and potentially North Korea, but also under the Anti-Terrorism Act against those who fund and sponsor Hamas.
What sort of cases have you represented for Israel, for the nation of Israel, people who've been injured here in the country?
Yes, so our work is multifaceted in our law firm, which, as I indicated, is Heidemann, Nudelman, and Kalik in Washington, D.C. First, we, as I've indicated, we represent victims, American victims. So an American victim who's killed or injured, his or her estate has a claim if they were killed. Plus, I'll repeat, their mothers, their fathers, their sisters, their brothers, their spouses, and their children, if they're American nationals, meaning American citizens, they all have eligible claims. Those claims are required to be brought within 10 years of the applicable of the terror attack. Same 10-year statute applies under the Anti-Terrorism Act. So we have represented many, many of the Americans killed or injured in the Second Intifada. We have a case pending now against Iran and Syria for having sponsored Hamas during the Second Intifada. And we just received a report and recommendation from the special master reviewing the claims of all of those family members. And the special master has issued a recommendation approaching $1.5 billion that is under review by the federal judge. But just a few days ago, as was reported in JNS last night, the U.S. District Judge for the District of Columbia, the former Chief Judge Royce Lambreth, who's handled many of the cases against Iran and Syria, issued a judgment on the claims that we brought as a result of the stabbing attack by a Hamas terrorist of Ari Fold. It took place in 2018, and Ari was stabbed there at the market. And even after being stabbed, he then chased the terrorist who was about to attack a falafel worker and he killed the terrorist, and then he was taken to the hospital, but he passed away tragically. So we sued on his behalf, Iran and Syria, and Judge Lamberth just awarded a $191 million judgment on behalf of Ari and his estate. We represent his estate, his mother, his father, all of his brothers except for one. And we also represent his surviving wife and children. And so this is one judgment for the family members that we represent of $191 million. Again, reported last night in JNS.org as the lead story at 6:30 last night when they released their edition.
I remember the story very well. This must be a tremendous relief for the families bringing those to account.
Well, it gives the families a measure of justice for all of the families. It's not about money. I mean, of course, money will be appreciated. It allows them to help support the children, the grandchildren, and themselves as a result of the heinous attack, and helps a certain measure of restoring the fiber and fabric of the family. But it's more important than that, because it's standing up against terror, not on the battlefield, that's left to the IDF, but it's standing up against terror in the courts, but also in the court of public opinion. We can see from October 7th that on October 7th, the world rallied to Israel's defense, recognizing Israel's right and obligation to defend her people and to hold Hamas accountable. But already by October 8th, Israel became, shall we say, the perpetrator, the offender, the violator, the occupier. It became all Israel's fault. That was the narrative. That narrative has grown. And so it's important that we stand up against the distortion and the denial of the truth of October 7th. And that's why we're working on cases that will be strategically filed now on behalf of the families that have engaged us. So the work that we do, truthfully, Paul, started out decades ago as a cause. It remains a cause, because we think it's important for the families to stand against terror, to speak out, to help diplomats and to help ordinary people understand that Israel and her citizens here are not the perpetrators, but rather are the victims. Let's focus for a moment not only on those that have been murdered and those that have been maimed. Let's focus for a moment on the hostages. You know, the theme that has been followed is bring them home, which of course puts the burden on the government, bring them home. And I'm not denying the obligation of the government to do everything possible to bring them home. But to me, the theme should be release the hostages. It's Hamas who took the hostages, Hamas who's holding and has abused the hostages. Many of them have been murdered, they've been raped, and they've been treated so violently, which is a violation of international humanitarian law. And release the hostages, for me, says to Hamas, you must release and return these hostages. You took them. It's your burden to care for them under international law. It's your burden to return them. And Hamas should be required to put down their arms, to surrender, and to allow the people of Gaza to return to their homes safely and to be able to get their kids into schools and get people back to work, not just for economic development, but for civil society to refunction. They're not under the terrorist organization Hamas, but rather to have a whole new administration that will help build a better day for the people of Gaza, the people of the West Bank, the people of Israel, the people of the region. And it's just simply wrong to hold Israel accountable for all the ills of the region. Everybody has to pitch in here. And the key is putting an end to the terror organizations that control the minds, that are teaching hate, that are giving weapons, that are teaching tactics of terror and war, that are teaching these young people about rape and about murder and about burnings and beheadings. It's unconscionable. And we have here the most documented, horrific terror acts since the Holocaust, since the Shoah. And we have to use that documentation to demonstrate the terrible conduct of Hamas. It cannot be allowed to continue, and we have to put a stop to their terror warfare, and we have to put a stop to the court of public opinion efforts to simply malign and demean and demonize Israel for defending and protecting her people.
How do you hold a group like Hamas responsible for the October the 7th massacre? It was a mass invasion. You don't know who's who. Do you hold individual Hamas members responsible? And is there evidence you can use to prove who's who? If people have gone back into Gaza with hostages, how do you hold them accountable? Or is it just basically chasing the money?
Well, Hamas is an acronym for an Arabic term that in English translates to the Islamic Resistance Movement. So what does that mean? It means that Hamas in its covenant is not just resisting certain activities of the state of Israel, but rather that they are totally rejecting the very existence of Israel. The United States designated Hamas as a foreign terror organization. It's illegal under U.S. law to provide support for a foreign terror organization. And it's illegal for countries such as Iran and Syria to, as state sponsors of terror, provide material support. There are reports that North Korean weapons have been found in Gaza. So we're examining that. But the charities, the foundations, the banks, the funders, the organizations that have provided support for Hamas under U.S. law are liable for their acts of terror and liable for aiding and abetting their acts of terror, even if they didn't pull the trigger or use the knife themselves. They can be liable and held liable under U.S. law. And it's not just about going after the money. It's more important to seek accountability and to have justice. So individual members of Hamas that may have committed attacks and can be proven in Israeli courts or in U.S. courts, and I know that the U.S. Department of Justice is looking heavily and deeply into the acts of the Hamas leaders in ordering and enabling these attacks of October 7th. And they're looking at bringing criminal indictments in the United States. And it's important to do so. You know, the information I have is that people from 42 different countries, Paul, were either killed, maimed, injured, beheaded, raped, taken hostage, 42 different countries. The presidents, prime ministers, foreign ministers, and diplomats of those countries should all be calling for accountability against Hamas. And Hamas, as a designated terror organization, must be put out of business. They cannot be permitted to control both the lives of the people of Gaza, people in the West Bank, but also people in Israel. Citizens, visitors, business people, people, vacationers, people who were at the Nova Festival just simply massacred or taken hostage. And all of that deserves and merits and requires justice and accountability. That is our goal, to help in the courts and in the court of public opinion to refocus people on the fact that October 7th was an act of Hamas and of Palestinian Islamic Jihad and others in Gaza who chose to invade the sovereign territory of the state of Israel, coming through the border fence between Gaza, from which Israel had withdrawn in 2005, 5, a unilateral withdrawal by Prime Minister Sharon. And it was under the control initially of the Palestinian Authority and later of Hamas itself since 2007. So for 17 years, Hamas has had the responsibility to feed its people. They blame Israel, but Israel hasn't occupied Gaza at all since 2005 when it unilaterally withdrew. And so we have to take these steps, and we have to understand that what Hamas wants is the total decimation of Israel, the removal of all Israelis and all Jews from all territories. And that fits right into the slogan that is being used in rallies around the world, quote, from the river to the sea. They're talking about from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. All that land they want to be free. That means free of Jews, free of Israelis. They want that land to be solely for Palestinians and Gazans and Arabs and Muslims and people other than Jews. They want to obliterate the sovereign state of Israel. Well, Israel is forever, and it's not going anywhere. Israel is forever. It's a full nation state, member of the United Nations for more than 75 years. It has rights. It has obligations to its people. It has the right and the obligation to defend its people. And Hamas will not win this terror war. It's the Hamas versus Israel terror campaign that has turned into a terrible situation for everyone. And the world must stand with Israel in defending and protecting her people.
Has your work given you an opportunity to speak to Congress?
It has. I was honored with the being called as a witness on behalf of American victims of Iranian and Palestinian terror. And we work with Congress regularly in an attempt to improve the laws that allows terror victims to bring cases. Many of the courts more recently have been denying those cases on various what I'll call technical or jurisdictional grounds. And Congress is looking at legislation now. And we hope that in the wake of October 7th, they will use this opportunity, even during this political season, to adopt a bipartisan bill that will protect the victims and that will give the victims greater access and rights to the courts, exactly as Congress intended when it previously adopted laws that, as I indicated, allows for American victims to sue state sponsors of terror, but also to sue non-sovereign entities, banks and charities and foundations and funders and contributors and supporters of terror organizations that commit to acts of terror, and to put a stop to the money that flows through U.S. correspondent banks and then out to those charities, and put a stop to the funding by charities of Hamas and others directly and indirectly, and put a stop to the raising of funds from U.S. taxpayers as tax-deductible contributions that go to support terror. And we hope and pray that and demand that Congress will indeed strengthen the laws exactly as it intended when it originally adopted the Anti-Terrorism Act.
UNRWA seems to have been involved in the October 7th attack. So can you hold them responsible? And can you actually stop the American government giving money to UNRWA to help the causes that they're actually supporting there?
Well, I'll take those questions in reverse order. As it relates to the U.S. government funding or not funding UNRWA, that's a decision of the United States president, the State Department, and of Congress. And so there are efforts to stop the U.S. government from funding UNRWA. But as I understand it, the Biden administration has actually suspended funding for a year. They're routing the money in different ways. And so whether that, and I know that litigation has been filed by some people against the Secretary of State and others in an attempt to stop that funding, and we'll have to see how that litigation goes. As it relates to holding UNRWA itself liable, UNRWA will claim that it is an arm, shall we say, of the United Nations, and it will claim immunity. But I know that litigation has been or is being filed against UNRWA. And then there's also litigation that other firms have filed and litigation that we have prepared to strategically file against U.S. entities that have provided support for UNRWA. Why is UNRWA a target? Everybody has to look at the real roots here. UNRWA teaches hate in the schools, but more than that, UNRWA has provided support, in my view, material support for the actual terror organizations, Hamas and Pidge and others, in various ways. And UNRWA must be held accountable. And the textbooks that UNRWA uses in the schools that it runs, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, are full of absolute indoctrination of hate of the minds of young people. It'll affect generations of Gazans and of Palestinians in the West Bank because they've been taught to hate in these UNRWA schools. UNRWA has a special jurisdiction as it relates to Palestinians. It was created by the United Nations just simply for Palestinian refugees, a very important creation at its time. But all other refugees in the world are, shall we say, administered by a different arm of the United Nations. I think the reference is the High Commissioner for Refugees. And all refugees around the world are resettled in the countries where they reside or to which they have moved when they became a refugee. Only Palestinian refugees, and I refer to the people whose ancestors were in the area of that became known as the State of Israel after the partition resolution by the UN in 1947 and Israel's creation in 1948 and her war of independence. People who became refugees, they have a special status. And unconscionably, the way they treat refugees from 1948, 1949, is if a grandparent left Israel, became a refugee, then they were a refugee, but they also count all their ancestors, which means there are grandchildren, great-grandchildren who claim to be Palestinian refugees, although they've never lived there in the area. They simply claim to be, and they're using the definition under UNRWA, which really is an anomaly and is wrong and must be changed at the United Nations itself. But of course, in the United Nations, it's one country, one vote. And no matter how you count it, you stack up all the people who are voting there, one country, one vote. And they're so biased that Israel loses those votes every time. But Israel has been losing less and less votes over the last years. October 7th, again, is a big game changer. All of a sudden, even at the United Nations, even in the Security Council, people are pointing the finger at Israel when Israel is the victim, not the perpetrator of October 7th. And Israel has the right, like every other country would have the right, if their towns were hit across the border with thousands of people being killed all in one day. No head of state would tolerate that. They would respond. They would respond with force, just as the United States responded after Pearl Harbor was hit. We responded. The United States responded, and the United States entered then World War II, and in order to stand up for freedom and justice. And that's what Israel is doing, is standing up for freedom and justice and defending her people. And hopefully it will end soon, but most importantly, hopefully a hostage agreement will be reached and every hostage from every country will be released by Hamas. We must all demand release the hostages and hold Hamas legally and diplomatically and in every possible way, accountable.
It sounds like a mission and a passion and a way for you to defend Israel. What is your website address for people who'd like to know more about the work that you do?
Yes, it's hnklaw.com, H. Heidemann, N. Noodleman, K. Kalicklaw.com. And I have a personal website, richardheidemann.com, that features both interviews and speeches and links to the two books that I've authored. The first, The Hague Odyssey on Israel's Battle for Justice at the United Nations, and the recent book, The Bloody Price of Freedom, detailing Israel's battle both against terror and the linkage between terror and anti-Semitism. What we're seeing today on the campuses and in the communities is pure hatred toward Israel and the Jewish people. It cannot be countenanced. It is pure, pure discrimination, and no religious group. And we are a religious group. No religious group should be discriminated against the way we are being discriminated against. And we thank all of the people of the world, from religions, from all walks of life, for who stand with Israel. And I remind people that the old city of Jerusalem has four quarters. They're not equal quarters, they're not 25%, but it has four quarters. It's the Armenian quarter, the Muslim quarter, the Christian quarter, and the Jewish quarter. And the holy city of Jerusalem is a city where, since 1967, Israel has taken the responsibility to guarantee freedom of access for people of all religions. And Israel has worked hard to protect the rights of Christians, to protect the rights of Muslims, protect the rights of people of the Baha'i faith, members of the Church of Latter-day Saints. Every single religion in Israel is protected. They have the rights of access to all of their holy places, both in Jerusalem and around the country. And we have to remember that Israel is the most vibrant democracy in the Middle East, the most vibrant democracy, perhaps outside of the United States, anywhere in the world. And as a democracy, it cherishes freedom and justice. This is not a time for political dialogue. This is a time to keep focused on the mission that's at hand. On the battlefield against Hamas and the terrorists, in the courts, and in the court of public opinion. So, to you and all of those who follow you, Paul, thank you for your support of Israel, of the Jewish people, and the people of all religions who are both in Israel and around the world who support Israel. Thank you for your support, for your love, and for your belief that Israel indeed is forever.
Well, Richard, thank you very much for coming and sharing today.
Thank you, Paul, for having me, and we invite everyone to join us in this effort. It is an effort that goes along with the saying, justice, justice, thou shalt pursue.
Thank you for joining us today. Pray that God will move by his mighty power in the Holy Land and bring his peace.